Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 22nd day of September 2011 here in Japan. And today I'm honored to be joined on the line by none other than Richard Andrew Grove, the infamous gang leader of TragedyAndHope.com, and also the man behind PeaceRevolution.org, and many other things and projects besides. Richard Andrew Grove, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for inviting me back, James. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, it has been quite a while since we've talked, so I'm glad to be doing this. And today we're going to be biting off more than we can chew, I'm sure, in one conversation on the history of corruption in public education. But I guess in order to start setting the groundwork for this, I think it's important to let people know about an exciting new resource on this topic that you're going to be coming out with very shortly, The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. So perhaps you can tell the listeners a little bit about this project and its history and sort of the details about when it's coming out.
Sure. The history on it is that for various reasons that I'll leave out of this direct interview, I've been looking into how the world actually works as opposed to the map they give us in public schools, because I had some experiences go on in my life that let me know that the map that I was given of reality was not indicative of reality. In fact, the map that we had all been given, I found, through public schools actually leads us into these pitfalls and these rabbit holes and all these sort of things. So I've been trying to get to the bottom of it and to figure out how we could have such problems around 9/11 and competency of the investigation thereof, how we could have this ongoing 10-year war without goals really established, let alone war being established, and how there's like a multitude of different subject areas, whether it's our water being poisoned, the air being poisoned, the food being poisoned, all these different things go on. But when you get to the root cause of how does this a group of elite managerial class type people pull the wool over the eyes of the general public? And in trying to answer these questions for myself, I found out that if you go back and actually study the history of how American public education formed, there's a lot there to be sifted through that is directly relevant to 9/11, the war on terror, everything that we're experiencing today, including this massive financial collapse, albeit slow, right? The dominoes are falling, but they're falling at a slow rate. So what we can do is observe this pattern of history that keeps repeating and observe what they took out of our public education system and then package that up and give it back to people directly. And so that's what I've been working on.
That is a noble quest, my friend, because I think looking for the patterns in history is in some ways a very simple task, but in some ways it's been taken away from us. It's been put out of our reach, and I certainly hope that that more people are tuned into this and are looking for those patterns in history to find out where we have been to in order to figure out where we're going. And I think this resource will be a handy way of doing that. So tell us a little bit about what this will actually physically be.
Physically, it'll be either a single 50 gigabyte Blu-ray disc that'll play high definition 1080p of the five-hour interview, or it'll be four DVDs in a box set. And it'll completely be fleshed out with, it has footnotes and everything already in the film itself. So when you watch it and Gatto talks about a certain book or a certain quote or what have you, I've already gone through and footnoted the book, the pages and the chapters for almost everything in there. There's over 200 footnotes during the 5 hours. We've also gone through the trouble of getting an accurate transcript created. And we're also going to provide many of the tools that we can give out for free that have been taken out of public schooling. So the five-hour interview is not meant to totally or comprehensively encompass anything. It's more a ramp. And as you listen to each hour, the ramp builds up until you finally get to the crescendo in hour five to see what it all means. And when you understand the patterns of history that have been formed that are so blatant, and people might have heard about this point or this point or this point, but no one's ever heard all these points explained together in context such that a family can sit together and truly have a learning experience. And you can spend a weekend watching this DVD set. You could spend 5 hours, 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years, because it would actually take you that long to comprehend and read all the source material that he's referring to. However, at the end of that five-year education, you would have an education that is superior to any PhD degree that's being given out at any university on the planet.
Absolutely incredible. And I'm extremely excited for this. I'm very much looking forward to it. And especially because I'm well familiar with John Taylor Gatto and his incredible work in this field. But perhaps we assume too much of the listeners. I know my longtime listeners will be familiar with Gatto. But for those who aren't, perhaps you can give us the synopsis of who he is and where he comes from.
Sure. The title of the project's An Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. And Gatto is a school teacher. He's from Western Pennsylvania. I'm from Western Pennsylvania. So I found an affinity for the poetic nature of his writing, because he's not just conveying information, but he's doing it in such a poetic fashion that when you look at what he's been able to teach kids in public schools over 28 years, and then how he ended up resigning, because he learned that he was being used to hurt children. So he resigns on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal. He then goes on to write, I think, 5 or 6 books on the topic of what is our public education system, who designed it, what is its actual purposes, what are the real ways that you get into college, what are colleges really looking for, what's the real way you get a job, what are employers looking for. So he's touched on all these topics because what he noticed was the way the system is set up. Let me make sure I answered your first question. Gatto, to this day, is active. He recently suffered a stroke and is recovering, but he'll be going forward and continuing to speak maybe by next spring or summer is what I've heard. So what we have is a school teacher who spent his entire career up until his, call it early retirement, he spent his entire career serving kids and trying to do his best within the system. And what he discovered was that the system actually uses the best teachers against everyone else, because they show that a broken system is continuing to work in these limited instances.
A broken system indeed, and broken in so many ways, and broken on purpose. And I think that's really part of the key history of what's going on here, and I'm sure that will be explored. But again, this is an exciting project. How will people actually be able to get their hands on it?
We'll be making the DVD available at tragedyandhope.com, johntaylorgatto.com, corbettreport.com, mediamonarchy.com. And the idea is that because this is a project that needs to be seen by a wide audience, what we're going to do is we're going to put the video up for free in a watermarked form on YouTube, so that people who don't want to buy the DVD set and just want to access the information and the notes and what have you have that access. And then for, you know, individuals and families and organizations that want to have the actual DVD set to study from, we're accepting donations now, because we're in post-production and haven't actually finished it yet. So people in the past couple of weeks who have donated $50 or more have gotten on a list of the early screenings of the first edition. And then from them, we'll productize it and make it available across many different sites that are either independent media sites that are commercial free, or other educational, alternative educational sites that are trying to get the word out.
Excellent. Well, again, some exciting stuff. So I really do hope people will stay tuned to tragedyandhope.com for more on that, and will hopefully join the Tragedy and Hope community to become a part of the conversation. As I understand, 1,000 voices and growing.
Yeah, there's about 1,200 people in there. And, you know, there's many people that subscribe to the podcast, and then a small percentage of those people take action because they want to take these next steps and figure it out. But I also understand that there's a lot of people who are hesitant because they don't understand what that's all about. Basically, what we provide is provocative media that's fact-based and reflective of reality, and we put it out to everyone for free. We also recognize the responsibility in doing that is I'm not just going to put this media out there and not give you a next step. We have a community where if you want to go in and find other people who are likewise trying to answer these questions, you can come into the community, you can act as an individual and go through all the tools yourself, but there's also a chat. There's also many groups in there where people want to work together because they're beyond just learning about these things, and now they're trying to get back to the civic activities that rebuild their communities in actuality.
Indeed, I think that is another crucial piece of the puzzle, and it's one that's not really available through CorbettReport.com at this time, so I'm glad that Tragedy and Hope is doing that, and I really do hope more people will get on board and will join that conversation.
Well, and you know that's open to your audience, man. It's not a mandatory thing that anyone has to pay. We just make sure that each individual is a human being. And if you appreciate the services that we provide and you can help us out, cool. And if you're struggling or unemployed or trying to get back on your feet, use the resources for free. That's what they're there for. But we just want to make sure that individuals are human beings and not spammers or predators.
You have to be a human being? What do you got against Reptoids, man? Come on. All right. Okay. Well, absolutely. Well, having said that and sort of established a bit of a groundwork, I'd like to get into the meat and potatoes of the conversation because, again, this is just such a huge topic, the history of corruption in public education. I mean, so much can be said about this, but I guess as a basis for starting out, we should perhaps start examining the system that of education that is not taught to you and me and the lowly minions out there, but that's taught to the elite level, I guess, rulers of society. And that phrase, I think, has a lot of caveats to it, but I think it generally goes to show the way in which this society is unfortunately being ruled. So let's start talking about the private boarding school system and where that came from and what it really teaches the managerial class of society.
Well, that's a fantastic question because that is the essence of what we're not being taught in public schools. And if you trace the origins of the private boarding schools, with the exception of possibly six, they were all started post-Darwin's publication of The Descent of Man in 1871 or 1872. Therein, Darwin explains, because he didn't in Origin of Species connect evolution to humanity. He just shows, and he never shows an origin of any species. Yet the forgotten name of his book was Preservation of the Favored Races, which he carries on in Descent of Man. So the point being, there's a bunch of elite aristocratic managerial class nobility, if you will, and they decide that they don't want their kids breeding with, for instance, the Irish, who were the lowest on Darwin's scale of 57 different races. And so in order to keep their kids from breeding with just anybody, they developed boarding schools. And so this all falls in line with the intermarriage among the elites and how they like to keep everything closely knit together. So these private boarding schools are teaching kids how to manage the rest of us. And they teach them a variety of methodologies, but some of the more insightful ones, which would help people understand what's going on, are the same things that you and I have had to do on our own outside the public education system, which are investigate the history and evolution of institutional forms, whether it's the prisons or the Democrats or the Republicans or anything that we see around us. We should have an idea of its origins and history and how it came to be in order to be educated and understand, you know, at least our community. The other things they teach are things like theories of human nature. What makes different people from different parts of the world tick? What things you have to say to certain people in certain vernaculars, whether they be Christian or atheist or what have you, in order to appeal to their beliefs. So the managerial class in private boarding schools, they're taught how to use words to manipulate other people to get what they want. One of the other things they teach would be mastery of the social forms, how to adopt the different mannerisms to take on and interact with different parts of society, to make them think that you're, you know, so it's like teaching kids how to use sheep's clothing as if you're a wolf, right?
Very, very good analogy, I think, in many ways. But that's, I mean, those points you touch on are so important because I think we are either trained or we just inherit a worldview in which all of those things which are interrogated in the private boarding school system are just accepted as part of sort of a static, unchanging reality. And so that people just accept the fact that there is Democrats and Republicans, there is a prison system, there are all of these institutions which obviously have come through and developed through a philosophical process throughout history, but we're taught to ignore that history, not think about it, and just accept these things as something that's always been there, monolithic entities that cannot be questioned. Similarly with theories of human nature, similarly with ways of communicating to different social groups. Again, all of these things are just accepted in our worldview, and when you actually start to interrogate where they come from, you can actually look at the ways in which they're used to manipulate us.
Well, that's fascinating because you mentioned a philosophic perception, which would be reminding me of the Panopticon. And then when you're talking about the social evolution of prisons, for instance, because if you look up Jeremy Bentham and the idea of the Panopticon, it is the, you know, the nanny state that we have here with the smart grid technology and everything spying on you, but you think it's your friend, right? Facebook's your friend, right? It's not a spy. And so, looking at this, Gatto says the same thing. It's the first question that I ask that elicits this answer, but he says, the only way I know what I think is that I sit down and I write it out and I argue with myself. And I think too few of us are given those tools to constructively question and argue with ourselves in order to find valid answers. But that's not the only tool they don't give us in public school. I haven't necessarily found evidence that they do give this out at all the public boarding schools, but these are tools that have been taken away from both sets of classes, which also makes the elite managerial class irrational. Tools like how to manage yourself and manage your time, right? They don't give us a way in public schools to know ourselves. They're not giving us organizational skills to manage our life or keep it in order. They don't give us a method by which we can validate the contents of our mind. They don't give us a method by which you can tell when people are lying to you. There's all these methods of, you know, for instance, resolving disputes and conflict. There are methods that do all these things that we find to be challenging or irritating or frustrating or confusing or fearful. There are methods that cut right through all these things. So anytime that we come up against fear or confusion, we have a method that translates that directly into knowledge and understanding. And so it's just an input you process and you have an output. So once you have these tools and methods back, which is, you know, what we're bringing out through the Gatto interview set and some other projects we have, once you have these tools and methods back, you have a great serenity and clarity of mind and ability to focus and actually get things done in a practical manner. But you know, the managerial class that's trained at private boarding schools, they don't necessarily need these tools because they have unfair advantage already.
That's absolutely right. But I think perhaps instead of thinking of the ruling class, the managerial class, as a monolithic entity in and of themselves, I mean, I think there must be different strata within that class. And there are those who are meant to be the mid-level gophers, and perhaps they're not given the same education as the people who are meant to be the real sort of technocrats.
That is an astute observation. So let me give you a specific instance. When we met with Jamie Johnson, who's the heir to the Johnson & Johnson family, he's technically a billionaire. When we met with him, he had been educated at NYU, which isn't an Ivy League school. I'm sure he had been to private boarding school, but he looked like a deer in the headlights the entire time I was explaining to him all the layers of evidence in whatever area you want to look around 9/11, the war on terror, everything going on with that. Your audience is very familiar with this. So when somebody who is supposed to be a lot better off than me and a lot better schooled than me is looking at me like it's the first time they've heard any of this stuff, and they really can't believe it, they can't reconcile it, cognitive dissonance is setting in with every fact that I'm setting in front of them because it does not compute. And at that point, I realized it doesn't matter because I'd watched Jamie's made two movies now, Born Rich and The 1%. Back when we had first met with him, I had just seen Born Rich. And there's the Cy Newhouse heir. There's several heirs to family fortunes in that film who have around $1 billion. And all of these kids looked lost and confused. And all I thought was, wow, that there's hope. Because if you put the right information in front of these kids who, yes, they're in those families, but they don't have the legacy. They're cut out of their companies. They are kept aside from everything that's going on. Jamie had nothing to do with the company. It had been, you know, out of his family for generations. He just still gets paid, right? And so the idea of trying to package up this information so that it's palatable, building out a ramp instead of saying, hey, here's a 100-foot cliff, now climb it, because this is reality, right? So we've taken the time to build out a long ramp that's really, you know, a slow incline so that everybody can get on wherever they can step onto it and start walking up in small increments, because it's your life that we're talking about. So this is going to be going on for the rest of your life until we all get together and figure out what's going on, how to resolve it, and actually take those actions. So you got to plan for the long haul. You got to get organized. You have to be serious about this. Otherwise, you're just, you know, you're wasting your time.
And that's exactly why I think I would, any day of the week, I would prefer knowledge and understanding over mere wealth, monetary wealth. I think it's just so sad to hear about that. I mean, people who literally can go through their entire life without ever needing to learn anything or to really understand how anything works. That's a waste of a human life, regardless of how much money might be in the bank account.
Well, now we've talked about what public school is not. So let's define what public school is. Public school, notice it's not called public education, it's called public schooling. The ideas behind public schooling, whether today or 2,000 years ago in Rome, where, you know, to teach the people how to be, you know, to teach crowd control, to teach things to the masses that enable them to be controlled by the few. It's an artificial extension of childhood in the last 60 years, because you can look at the textbooks from the 1950s. These textbooks speak about the importance of independent thought, how to have debates, all these sort of things that you would need to have a healthy community and strong civic responsibility. Those textbooks have been changed drastically in the last 60 years, and the purposes of schooling have, they've lost their facade, where, you know, the facade of it's actually about education, and it's gotten down to, it is about indoctrinating and training habits and making sure that everyone in the class thinks it the same way about certain things. That makes everyone predictable. It makes statistics and forecasting predictable for the government, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, so this started in its most realistic form in 1918, and there's a book that is cited by Gatto in the interview that once we heard it, we're like, we all got to look this book up. So several of us have attained copies of it. It's called Principles of Secondary Education. It was printed in 1918, and it's a Yale book. So, or maybe it's Harvard. But the point is, in there, this guy Ingalls defines the six purposes of education. And the people who have created the whole system, they've been working off a plan. So these six steps have continued to remain in effect till today. So when you think about, what do we still use from 1918, aside from things like Federal Reserve? But there's not a whole lot from 1918 that we still use in its current form, except the design of public schooling. And so the design of public schooling gets around these six points, and the first being the adjustive function. This is the establishment of fixed habits of reaction for each student. So if there's a fire, everybody acts a certain way. If there's some other accident, everyone acts a certain way. If someone says this sort of thing, everyone reacts a certain way. So it's Skinnerian or Pavlovian programming of students. The second is the integrative function, which is the development of like-mindedness, unity of thoughts, habits, standards, ideals, all the sort of things that we're supposed to aspire to. This is where we got the notion of the American dream. This sort of thing is instilled through school. This is why they need us for 15,000 hours. It's not just about education. The third is the directive function. It tells you what you're to do. It marks you in your social class for, are you going to be a plumber? Are you going to be a technician? Are you going to be an engineer? Are you going to be a doctor? These sort of things. So part of the teacher's job is to label you and to basically set you on this path for your future. The differentiating function is to assure social solidarity. It takes advantages of differences among students to divide and conquer and ensure they don't have enough upward mobility in life. So it cements you in your social caste. You're labeled. It's the teacher's job to label you. And then you're set in your social caste, and you're not supposed to really be mobile from that, which is the same thing that Darwin says or the Anglican religion says, because these things are all tied together through the phenomenon of schooling. The fifth would be the selective function. This is the elimination of individuals who do not meet the managerial class's criteria for future workers. So if you're a bright, intelligent, curious young person who likes to learn, guess what? You don't really fit in the corporate world. They don't want people with integrity and morals and ethics and standards and, you know, protocols of how to get things done. They don't want that. They want good little worker bees who aren't going to question anything. And the propaedeutic function, which is the sixth, is there to identify the next managerial generation of the elite. So these are the people who are going to run things, and they don't need people who aren't in that class to learn how to run things. That doesn't really fit in with their system. So what you find is you've got this strange functioning of the public school system. So the question is, why do public schools have that form and function? Well, to answer that question, you look at, where does it originate? Public schooling in its current form today originates back in the early 1900s with the Vanderbilt family, the Astor family, the Carnegie family, the Rockefeller family, all these robber baron families who created the teachers' pensions and then gave teachers tenure, which is a guarantee that they can't be fired as long as they play along with certain rules. And this is enough to get teachers to lie to our children for the past 100 years. It's a system that keeps working, so they haven't fixed it yet. How am I doing?
Oh, I think that was a mouthful and a half. Well, you know, Rich, as someone who prides himself on his vocabulary, I must admit I have never in my life encountered the word propaedeutic or even could guess at the etymology of that word. So that's something that on my to-do list, look up that word.
I'm pretty sure it's a Greek word and it has to do with adults and children, but I would likewise need to do some more epistemological nomenclature research on that.
Interesting. But, well, the AE kind of gives it away as, I think, a Greek etymology. But anyway, absolutely fascinating stuff. And just my observation on that, as someone who has not only taught in the education system for several years, but actually taught in Japan specifically, I must say that the Japanese do an absolutely marvelous job of those six functions and really do follow them to a T. And to me, what that suggests perhaps most interestingly is the way in which the cultural imperialism has really spread this idea out throughout the globe, because having read a fascinating history of some of the historical educators here in Japan, I know that this is very much not the way that education used to function in Japan. So I think there's been a very concerted effort to really introduce this system and to make it part of the system, probably, I imagine, introduced during the period of American administration after the World War II. So absolutely fascinating stuff, and it is spreading out across the globe. And the question really, I guess, is how to stop it.
Well, the way to stop it is by learning. Let's learn 2 more minutes of history about Japan and the Prussian education system, which is what I was just referring to, because it's the importation of Prussian education to America that corrupts the entire education system. I happen to know, because I interviewed Gatto and he talks about this, and it's fascinating what you can learn when you interview somebody, right? He tells this great story about Admiral Perry and how Japan was really opened up to trade, and it was by threat of force and coercion and fraud and all these beautiful things that are the American way. But what he says thereafter really shocked me, and it was that because of how this character Wilhelm Wundt, who created the Prussian PhD system, so anyone who has a PhD today, the lineage goes back to this guy who created it, Wilhelm Wundt. Wundt lived in Prussia. And they came up with the idea after they had lost this war against Napoleon at Battle of Jena in 1805, that the reason that their soldiers lost is because they were too well educated, and that people who are really well educated don't make good soldiers, because you do logical things like ask questions while you're fighting and while you're risking your life and these sort of things. So they wanted to dumb down their entire population to make them a militaristic society. It worked so well, they then exported it around the world. And in the late 1800s, Japan loved this idea so much that they imported the Prussian constitution almost word for word. So if you see a Prussian influence in the education system there, it's not alone. It doesn't stop at China either. Gatto said he's been to China 6 times. They keep wanting to they know that they're controlling people like machines, but they want to keep it that way. But they want the people to be more happy as they're being treated. They want them to learn to love their servitude. And so this is just the irony of, you have nations who understand that, yes, we're treating our people like they're machines and have no soul, but we want them to be happy about it. And will you help us figure it out, right? And so it's by learning that history that we can put a stop to it, because it's only when you are not intellectually able to defend yourself or physically able to defend yourself that you get into trouble. The big deal is that most people, you're not fist fighting every day. This isn't, the Wild West. This, we don't need violence, but we do need intellectual self-defense, because we are being attacked on a cognitive level, bombarded every day, all day. And if you have the methods to dispel confusion and to be able to deal with these things and see them in their totality, in their context, in a comprehensive nature, you're much better able to learn about them, figure out what the moving parts are, what they've taken out, and how to put it back. It all becomes very simple once you take away the complexity.
Absolutely. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. I mean, I must plead ignorance of the history of Japan. I mean, I know about Admiral Perry and the opening up of Japan to outside trade during the Meiji era, but I don't really know about the importation of the Prussian Constitution. But that does certainly make the penny drop in terms of, the formation of the German-Japanese axis back in World War I, World War II. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. So definitely I need to do more self-schooling on that topic. But again, I think it goes to show the exportation of this cultural system that has unfortunately been taken over by a lot of governments that, of course, like to keep their people dumbed down and unquestioning and try to make them happy while they do so. I guess we've touched on this a little bit in terms of who is responsible for public schooling. You pinpointed private schooling origins in Darwin, but how about public schooling? Where does it come from? Who does it come from? What are the philosophical roots of this system?
Well, traditionally in civilization, since there have been towns and communities and what have you not, kids were taught at home, usually by their parents, and if not, they had a local teacher. And this was all done informally, non-governmentally. It was done, you know, with form and function in mind. And what you have is that comes up through, you know, the Dark Ages. People were still being taught at home. And up through about 1300, 1400, the first organized public schools appear in Scotland, but only kind of as a function of the Templars' exodus, it seems. What you have then is the schools being put together by communities, so you do have public schooling, but there's no mandate per se. And when you get around to universal, mandated, forced, you know, compulsory schooling, which is what public schools are all around the world, they have truant officers and school taxes and all these sort of other sort of things. This was all created more recently in the last 100 years by the rich aristocratic elite robber baron families like the Rockefellers, Carnegies, Astors, Vanderbilts, early 1900s. Around that time, Standard Oil was having a lot of problems with labor, and there was the Ludlow massacre. There was all these sort of things that were drawing attention to the nature of these corporations and their capitalist antics that were against, you know, human survival in many cases. And there was this, I believe he was a Baptist minister named Frederick T. Gates, who approached Rockefeller and he said, look, you got to let me handle your money. You need this thing called philanthropy. It's going to convince everyone that you're a great guy. And so Rockefeller and Gates partner up. Well, then Rockefeller creates the General Education Board. He invests millions of dollars into it. And then he appoints Frederick T. Gates to be the first, you know, executive director of this General Education Board. So what you have are people like Carnegie, who also had labor problems, learning how to buy the public. And you buy the public either through your foundations or your donations. Or in Carnegie's case, he donated an organ to all these different churches. And then, of course, even though he's an atheist, all these churches thought he's a great guy. With Rockefeller, he had multiple philanthropies, but the Rockefeller Foundation and its affiliate foundations, the Ford Foundation and some of these other ones, Carnegie Foundation, Carnegie Endowment, are all instrumental in creating, literally creating and mandating from the top down, the public school system in America. And during the 40s and 50s, there were several, there was the Walsh Committee in 1918, and then the Cox and Arise committees in the 1950s that looked into the origins of foundations and the nature of their antics and activities with schools. And what they found was the elite corporations that had created these foundations as proxies were then being used to undermine everything about the American way of life and the Canadian way of life and Japanese way of life by removing and redefining. More importantly, it's a process of redefining their culture. And so when people come in and spend a lot of time with you and take you away from your parents at a young age, you become very, you know, influenced by those people. And if you, especially if you think they're there to help you and to teach and make you learn or help you to learn. But in reality, what you find are kids are stripped, literally stripped of their curiosity, their creativity, their self-reliance, their self-esteem. Anything that could make them a solid, responsible grown-up eventually is stripped away. And that leaves somebody who has to be totally dependent, you know, like a adolescent for everything. You think you know what's going on as a teenager, but you really don't. You're not paying the bills, you know, at that know-it-all age. They've created a whole culture where no matter what age you are, you think you know what's going on, and yet you've never put any research into defining anything around you, so you depend on what people have told you it is. And even though there's a lot of, you know, well-meaning, well-intentioned people, are they well-informed? Are they using their five senses and observing reality and finding something that's objective that actually exists? Or have they skipped all those steps of verifying their reality? And are we discussing something that's arbitrary and insubstantial and actually a waste of our time, a rabbit hole? There is a way to get to the end of the rabbit hole, but you have to ask the right questions in the right order, and that's the methodology.
Absolutely. Well, I think you bring up an important point of all of this, which is not only that the children are being taught not being taught how to think, but that I think societally, culturally, in terms of our civilization, we've been taught how not to teach. And you bring up the point of historically, most cultures have the concept of parents raising their children and teaching them what they need for survival. And it's amazing to think that we've really managed to strip that away and make that seem like a foreign or strange concept, where it just seems natural to give our children to government agencies to rear and raise and to indoctrinate from the time that they're basically old enough to walk and talk.
Well, and it seemed natural to give those organizations known as public schools the rights to have, you know, mandatory vaccinations, because you have a bunch of kids coming together and viruses or bacteria can be communicable, so we should protect against that. That seemed like form and function matched up back then. But when you have a school system today, which is all only there to condition and program your child for a future life in the status quo, and at the same time, in some states like California, they're going to make the Gardasil injection mandatory. And not just Texas, where they said they did it, but they didn't really do it. There's a document on the governor's table in California right now where schools are going to do this. And I've already seen so many other inhumane actions taken by schools, such as the drugging of children. If your kid has too much curiosity and is perceiving too much of life, they've got a problem, and we have to put them on this drug for the rest of this life, their life, right? And so it now just becomes a sales depot for pharmaceutical, you know, organizations and police and tactical and security organizations and all these other things that have nothing to do with education. If you asked what are the steps to learning, it works like this. You have to be able to observe. You use your five senses. You then ask valid questions and find substantial answers. That's it. If you know how to do that, you've now learned how to learn anything. And it didn't cost you anything but a little, you know, 30 seconds of attention and actually focusing on what I was saying. But that's the secret. College and public schools and all these things were not created for the purpose that we have all assumed. And I would never believe this had I not spent thousands and thousands of hours researching and looking into this to find the source materials to then help, you know, create this interview set and put all the footnotes and references in there. So it's not just a, you know, a word or a phrase that goes over your head. You know, this, the only way to learn is to pause the disc, write it down, look it up, just like what you said when I said propaedeutic. Propaedeutic. You know what I'm saying?
I think I do. All right. Well, I guess the question really becomes, to what extent is our freedom, the possibility of our freedom, predicated on our ability to think critically?
Well, if you don't have the ability to question propaedeutic, that's a fun word to say improperly. If you don't question the words you hear, I'm just using it as an example because I think it's about our habits. They control us by our habits. And so you had the habit of asking yourself the question, is that a word I know? Do I need to look it up in order to understand the sentence? Well, I defined the word by its context, and you were able to understand what I was saying, even though you didn't hear this word before, right? So that's all it is. It starts with the questioning in the mind, your internal conversation, where it's no longer just stimulus and response. You're putting thinking in between the stimulus and response. And what is thinking but asking the questions and attaining the answers of the who, what, where, what, why, and when, and how of the situation? The five W's plus how is what I'm trying to say. And if you answer those five questions, that's thinking. You're actually doing thinking between your input and your output. That makes you a human being, in my opinion. You have to be thinking. There are plenty of people who let stimulus and response control them, and they're no longer consciously participating here. They've turned themselves into scenery, and I think that's kind of sad, but everyone has the choice to just start asking questions, because if you don't start somewhere, you'll never get started. But if you, you know, just ask a couple questions, let nature take its course. You can get out there. The information is out there. We try to put it all in one place and give people a map to it because it's so massive. You can delve into any of your favorite areas, something that, you know, if you're a professional, you have expertise, you can look at, you know, something that's applicable that you could easily understand. But the point is that with a little bit of concentration, all of this is understandable. And that the people that are ruining this planet don't really understand what's going on, which is why they've taken so many irrational, you know, actions and plans. They're just really organized and good at it, and they don't get organized resistance. That's the difference between the managerial class and the rest of us. Is they're organized, they have a plan, they have an agenda. they think that, you know, they have justification, whether it be from God, you know, through the Bible or through science via Darwin, to be and act as justified sinners, which means that nothing they do is going to damn them and that nothing we do is going to save us. And I think we can do better than that.
Justified sinners telling noble lies, I guess. Absolutely. Well, that does raise so many important points, but one point that occurs to me is that if really what I'm seeking is nothing other than the nullification of their plans, is that a plan in and of itself?
Well, sure, if, you know, it's wave cancellation. I don't see the need to be dominant, but I do see the need to stop letting their signals dominate me. I call their signals noise because it's the anti-human actions that they're trying to put into all of us, whether it be, you know, here's a pretty girl, buy the product, or any of these other things that they do to manipulate people. You know, you have to say no to that, starting with your observation and your unwillingness to take in those signals anymore, because they don't contain signals that help you survive and thrive. Rather, it's, you know, they're giving you signals that are contradictory to human survival. They're, you know, they're doing all sorts of things that are irrational. And I guess that's why you and I are doing what we do every day, because we see that it's irrational. It doesn't have to be this way. And that, you know, if we just put back the pieces that they've taken away, if we give people back their ability to be self-reliant, to think clearly, to get things done that, you know, delivers consistent, achievable results, that's it. That's all they had to take away from us to make us incoherent as a nation and as individuals.
Indeed. Well, I think you and I are very much on the same page, because to me, again, it comes back to the idea of not wanting to create some sort of overarching system or telling people what to think or anything of that sort, just simply trying to detach people from the system of control that they've tried to set up and engineer for us. And I think obviously learning how to learn is an absolutely crucial step in that. And it's the first step, and there are many steps to come after that. But I think if without that first step, we'll never start the journey.
Well, and there's a quote that I find to be poignant when you get to this place where you're trying to understand these sort of concepts. And the quote is, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space," I'm continuing on my own now, "in that space is where your freedom comes from, because it's in that space where you make your choices. It's in that space where you ask questions and actually go out and seek some more information, because you don't have enough information yet to make an informed decision, right? It's in that space where all the freedom comes from. So if we don't take on a process of getting organized, thinking, that's asking questions, and learning, that's answering those questions and noticing the patterns, then, you know, there's no hope. But if we do that, there's plenty of hope for individuals to act, you know, with self-reliance and be able to not have their actions injure anyone else or impede, you know, infringe upon the volition of others. So as long as we all have the ability to make informed decisions, the volition returns. There's no need for, you know, people talk about anarchy. Anarchy is just the absence or vacuum of government. It doesn't automatically give the people back self-reliance and critical thinking and these methods of survival and thrival. So, you know, you see a situation like the economy building the way it is or any of the other things. It's sad. It's kind of gloomy. But the point is, it doesn't have to continue to be that way when these tools, when these solutions, when these methods are so close to getting out there to everybody. All it takes is a little attention on your part to realize the value of it and the nature of it, and then the astuteness to pass it on to others who are, you know, looking for answers and actually trying to participate in this game called life.
Tragedy and hope, one might say, as long as one remembered to append .com to that when entering it into an address bar in your browser.
Absolutely. You're so good with the puns. I let the noble lie go, but I want to say to your audience that James here in 2007 was talking about Strauss and the noble lie well before, you know, because I've been talking about it for the past couple of years, and I was just humbled to see that you were so far ahead of the curve, and that, because it's a very potent idea, the fact that there is this noble lie, that Plato comes up with it, that it's been carried on as a philosophy, that the neocons use it, that the people who did 9/11 subscribe to this, and that the noble lie only works when the audience is so believing. And I say, let's just not be so easy to convince. Let's make people actually show us evidence. And I would like to learn something during the process, right? And I think that this would all go on a lot more fluidly once we all realize that we need to have a method to identify that which exists and to dismiss that which doesn't. That makes the whole crime of 9/11 a lot easier to solve when you're not chasing things that don't exist, right?
I agree 18,000% with that, and I think absolutely that cuts both ways, because just as people can be fooled and tricked by the establishment, they can be tricked just as easily by the alternative media and people who just don't use their critical thinking when looking at facts, and they can lead you down speculative rabbit holes that go nowhere. And I think people definitely have to have their critical thinking in place and use it as their shield when they're battling their way through this incredible struggle to try to find the truth about anything. And I think too many people leave the establishment to join the alternative flock, and it's no better, really, in many senses.
And the only way that it's going to get better is for us to notice some of these recurring patterns. So we just talked about Plato and the idea of a noble lie. Let's go 1,000 years ahead in time and look at Johann Fichte. And Johann Pestalozzi and Caspar Lavater, these were all people influential in creating the Prussian education system. Immanuel Kant, and then all these people influenced Hegel. So everyone knows about the Hegelian dialectic. Well, here's all the philosophical influences that gave Hegel his boldness, right? I'm trying to say Hegel more the way it's supposed to be said, so I'm saying Hegel now in case you were questioning that.
I wasn't, but I am now.
You should, because in the interview said, I didn't say Fichte properly. So now forever when people see me say Fichte, they can have a little giggle, because I did some learning that day. So Fichte, Pestalozzi, Lavater, Hegel, they all were either in the Illuminati or had Illuminati mentors. Caspar Lavater, who created some of these first kindergarten-type experiments in Switzerland, experimenting on homeless children, et cetera, et cetera. These all have Illuminous ties, and the whole agenda of the Illuminati was to take away our tools of learning. That the Trivium is not only the Masons' high secret, it's at the end of Morals and Dogma on page 861, it's the royal secret of the Sublime Prince, is the 3-4-5 triangle and knowing the Trivium, Quadrivium, and your five senses. So the highest secrets that these societies aren't secret, they hold secrets. And what do they hold secret? Useful information that if they withhold from the public gives them almost total control and dominance from an intellectual perspective. They keep us as children and they like to act as adults. And all I'm saying is if we proliferate this information and allow people the opportunity to grow up at their own pace, they don't have to do it in one day, but at least start in the process to develop as a full-blown adult who can have these tools and be confident and self-reliant in reality, instead of based on something that we pay money for it at Walmart.
Well put. So yes, the answer to the salvation is not going to come by paying Walmart or paying money in any sense. And that's again one of the false solutions that we're taught. What are some of the things that we've lost from the public's from being subjected to the public schooling system?
Well, we've lost our ability to recognize problems when they happen. I mean, we live in a nation of CSI watchers and NCIS type of, law and order crime solving shows where everything's solved in an hour. You see the crime at the beginning of the show, then they solve it by the end of the show. It's very comfortable. Yet our entire nation is not able to recognize when real crimes are going on, how to dismiss these arbitrary false flags that have government, taxpayer money written all over them. So we've lost our ability to observe when things are out of normalcy because we can't recognize normalcy anymore. We've lost our ability to be persistent and self-reliant. We lost methods of intellectual self-defense, how to dispel confusion, how to test reality to see if what we're actually thinking, talking, doing is actually part of reality, or if we're talking about, we might as well be talking about what we had to dream last night. Right? Because it doesn't apply to anyone else except it's a subjective experience, right? So if we can move away from subjective experiences, talk about objective experiences, that's where communication can truly start to begin. So we've lost our ability to communicate clearly. We've lost our sense of epistemology, which is a method of acquiring knowledge in the first place. We've had a loss of truth, which can be referred to as solipsism. This is the legacy of Immanuel Kant. And if you look at what happens when you take away objective reality and take away cause and effect, take away consequences of the nature of you know, natural reality, then you can make anything into the truth and teach it to children, and they don't have any defense because, you know, they're just trusting in their authorities. This, of course, makes everyone reliant on these authorities. We've had a loss of judgment and the ability to make informed choices, partially because we can't recognize what exists. And therefore, we've lost freedom from a number of angles, which results from deleting the thinking between stimulus response. So if we've lost our freedom from that process, let's reverse it. You have thinking between stimulus and response. That equals freedom. Get more individuals practicing freedom in a self-reliant, responsible way where they're not infringing upon the volition of others. Then you have a society that can grow and thrive and be sustainable without any of these crazy corporate foundational Al Gore, UN type of things going on that are trying to get into everyone's lives.
That's a key point, because I think a lot of the solutions that we inherently just naturally know to be solutions are co-opted and corrupted and are taken over and are basically used by the establishment as ways to lead us down false paths. And again, without our understanding of history and how techniques of manipulation have been used in the past, we'll never be able to escape that cycle. So it sounds like people are in need of a history lesson, an ultimate history lesson, if you will.
Yeah, well, they definitely are in need of an ultimate history lesson. Unfortunately, the DVD set that we've created only gets you on their first couple steps. After that, you're going to have to continue taking steps, but I can promise that it's going to be more fun than you thought it was going to be, because there's a lot of interesting people that are also, you know, going on this journey, trying to find the answers to the same questions. You're going to make new friends. You're going to find out new things about life that give you a lot of encouragement and inspiration and the tools that you need to be more successful and to have a, you know, a more serene mind while you're experiencing all this new information. So you had just said something there at the end that I wanted to let me see if I can recapture it. You lost me, James. You had said something there at the end, and I thought that is such a good – oh, you noticed the pattern that they redefine our terms. That's it. If you like, that's such an astute observation that I just had to trip over myself to comment on it for you, because Gatto says during the interview that the way that they've taken over culture after culture after culture after culture is to come in and redefine the everything. So it's called liberty, but really it's tyranny. And so this is what they had talked about, whether it's 1984 or Brave New World, Huxley and Orwell. These ideas that were just ideas back then are actually being carried out with success now. And to put a cap on it, I'll refer to a Bertrand Russell book, Impact of Science on Society, because in there he's talking about how Fichte had planned to do all this control to society, but he didn't have the technology. And Bertrand Russell's like, now we have the technology to actually do all this stuff, to make people love their servitude. In fact, they won't even know that they're serving. They'll just think they're loving life, but they'll know that there's something wrong with it, and they'll keep being reminded of this every day as they're confused and in fear, right? And so, you know, they've had an easy go of it because we haven't put up much resistance. They've taken away these tools, and nobody is coherently trying to give them back to a large number of people at once. And I'm just interested to see what would happen if you had a bunch of people who regained their individual freedom and had intellectual self-defense, had the confidence to take actions with high degrees of certainty, and to be able to put all these compartmentalized PhD pseudo experts in their place. Because once you learn, truly learn for yourself using this methodology, you'll see that you have a superior weapon on the battlefield of the info war.
Very well put. Well, I would say that we've been fiched by Fichte, and we can get out with Gatto, but that would be just too punny for a family-friendly program like this. So I think I'll get out while the getting's good. And I think we have bitten off an incredible amount of information in this conversation, so perhaps we'll let the listeners chew on this mentally for a little while. But I guess in wrapping up this conversation, any other points that you wanted to make about this topic?
Well, if we've done anything during this hour-long conversation, it should have stirred up your curiosity a little bit. So let that marinate, and then when you're ready to start taking some more steps forward and learning, the entire Peace Revolution podcast that I've put out over the past couple years is a curriculum. It's an informal curriculum where you are your own teacher, but you're being given the tools, the techniques, the methods, everything that they've taken out of the public school system. you know, one episode at a time, so it's easy for people to intake. And then from there, if you want to learn more and interact with people and participate in groups and figure out where we are actually at right now, what needs to be done, and how do we introduce this bigger picture to more people, then there's the Tragedy and Hope online community, which is at tragedyandhope.com.
And might I just throw in a little plug for Peace Revolution, because it seems that pretty much every episode I either get an idea for an episode of my podcast to expand on something that you've put in there, or you've already covered something I was going to cover, which is great, because that means that, you know, many hands make light work, so that information is out there in the zeitgeist anyway. So it's absolutely an informative podcast, and I couldn't recommend it highly enough.
Well, I think that's just the convection current of causality going on, because I am likewise inspired by your productions as well as Mr. Pilato. And I really couldn't get through my week without them, because you guys both do different things that are very complimentary. And I really couldn't feel well informed unless I've had my Media Monarchy and Corbett Report for the week.
All right. Well,
and my Global Research Television, now that you're making these videos, that last one on 9/11 conspiracy theory, man. I mean, you made me laugh. You made me laugh. You made me cry all at the same time. I was like, this is brilliant. So I'm glad to see that you're stretching your wings, that you're getting a lot of support, that people are respecting you for your hard work and your intelligence gathering, and that it's all coming together for you. And as a subscriber to your 100 yen negotiated agreement, I know every time I see that come out every month that it's going to a good place, that I am going to continue to get inspiration and energy and nutritious thoughts. So I'm glad you came out with that, and I hope more people support it.
Well, I thank you very much for that. And without that, without the support of people like yourself and all the other listeners out there that are doing this, I wouldn't be able to do this in the form that I am, and to keep up with all the, you know, the technology and all the stuff that we need to do these types of media enterprises. So absolutely thank you to you and to everyone out there who is supporting the Corbett Report, and also Media Monarchy and Peace Revolution and all of the other various independent media that are out there attempting to spread the word about this and succeeding or failing in various ways, but hopefully just adding to the overall enlightenment of society. And again, it's just a question of educating yourself and helping to educate others once you've learned those first few steps. So it is an incredibly overwhelming process, but we're in it together, and I guess we'll either hang together or we'll hang separate. And unfortunately, that can be taken quite literally. So
no, that's a good historic pun to close it down on, because I think you're punned out by now.
I think I've given it my best. All right. Well, Richard Andrew Grove, once again, always a pleasure to talk with you, and always an honor to be involved with Tragedy and Hope and all of the things that are going on there. So once again, I hope people will go there and use that as the springboard or a starting point if you haven't done so yet. Anyway, we will leave it there for now. So once again, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
The feeling is mutual, and thank you everyone for tuning in and not dropping out.